the aircon is cooling the room ever so slightly in the Hotel Kaleli in Gaziantep, which is kind of southeastern Turkey. I just looked at the map and I didn't realise how far I travelled from Istanbul last night. I arrived in the early hours of the morning and I was really excited to get to this small backstreet hotel because I was catching up with a very good friend of mine, Phil Sands, who writes for The National and has spent an awful lot of time in this neck of the woods, Syria, Damascus in particular, Baghdad. We've worked together in Amman, Jordan, Cairo, Egypt, Khartoum, in Sudan. Scary moments sometimes.
Yeah, it's true. I've forgotten all of those places, actually. It's amazing how the time passes, isn't it? Especially Sudan. And yeah, silly.
So how come you're not in Damascus right now?
I left Damascus. I'd lived there for years. I mean, 3.5, I always say, but it might have been more. And I was registered there as a journalist and so forth. But in February, a couple of months ago, my work credential expired and the government didn't renew it. And so I was obliged to leave the country, basically. It was, maybe a little bit dramatic to say it because I wasn't kicked out, but I was kind of, asked to leave without being asked to leave, which is a very Syrian thing to do, a very Syrian way of doing it. It's difficult to work there as a journalist, and I'd been to some contentious places and written from some contentious places, and I think that was kind of, maybe that was noted, and it'd been conveyed to me that they weren't happy with that, and so I didn't get my renewal, and I think I had been the only Western journalist, living and working there throughout the, what do we call it? They call it a crisis, throughout the revolution, throughout the war, and so I was in a privileged position for a couple of years, and now I've lost that privileged position.
What was Damascus like when you got there, and what is it like now?
I guess I got there a long time ago, and it struck me as being a very beautiful city, and I was kind of quite taken with it. It's in a sort of naive way, I guess I fell in love with it. It had a certain charm that's hard to describe, I suppose, but everyone always says, or everyone used to say, if you go to Damascus, you do kind of fall in love with it, and I think people do, and I did. Obviously it changed, by the time I left it was a war zone, jets were bombing the neighborhood next door to me, there were militias in the streets, people with headless corpses were found, a few hundred yards from my flat and stuff, and so it had changed a lot, but one of the things that I always think is that, in fact, the Damascus I knew at the beginning was a lie anyway, because the things that are transpiring now would not have been possible had Damascus been the beautiful, wonderful place that we all saw as foreigners, effectively, and it was kind of a naive thing to think, because beneath the surface, all this discontent was always there, and all these problems and the government and the police state and the lack of reforms and the economic inequality, and there was a huge drought which pushed, hundreds of thousands, millions into poverty, and people were kind of, maybe it's a slight exaggeration, but starving to death. People were malnourished in Syria, hundreds of people forced off the land, and so all these things were boiling away. And of course, if you live in the upper class neighborhood in central Damascus, you don't get to see all of that. If you live in the place where all the embassies are, but I had a couple of years ago moved out and lived in rural Damascus in a middle class neighborhood, which I suppose would be by Western standards sort of a slum, I suppose. But it was, it was a nice place and nice people and stuff. But we got to see much more of that. You're out there where people are rooting through the bins and stuff, and so you had a much greater sense of these problems. That's one of the things that I keep coming back to, is that people always say, Damascus was so lovely and now it's gone and it's changed and it's such a tragedy. And of course, in a way it is, but in another way, the Damascus that everyone's talking about never existed. It was a figment of their imagination. It was one we all like to pretend was there, and in fact, it wasn't.
I remember many years ago when we both worked at the Northampton Chronicle and Echo, the early 2000s, and you kind of had a bit of a disdain for... I don't think they were called parachute journalists back then, but you were always questioning the stories that were coming out of people that just kind of landed, pointed cameras, spoke to a couple of people near the airport, got back on a plane and came out. And you have done the opposite. You've totally submersed yourself in the region that you're documenting that you're reporting from, is that the only way to do it?
I mean, no, I don't think it is. I'm probably in a way less militant about that than I used to be. And I would say, like, I don't report on the region as well. You know, I have some kind of sense of Syria, although it's not, it's far from exhaustive. You know, I know bits and pieces about certain areas. And so it's not even a Middle East. I wouldn't even claim to know about the Middle East. You know, I sometimes feel it's a bit much to claim to know anything about Syria because it's so complicated. But yeah, on the one hand, I do think, you know, my own experience is I find it really difficult to understand anything quickly. I don't know if I'm just slow on the uptake, you know, but it takes me a long time to get my bearings and to know things. And I think Syria is very much a country where that's true. You know, I had people who I'd known for years. It was only at the end that they would start to trust me. You know, it takes that long to break through these barriers of fear that have been instilled over years and years and years of living in a police state where if you say the wrong word, you can disappear. And that's the truth of what Syria is. And so, yeah, on the one hand, I think it is important for Syria. On the other hand, you know, I think there are journalists that parachute in, as you say, and they do, and as I would say, but they do really important work. You know, they get in and they see things that you don't see if you've been living there a long time. You know, I'd find it hard to explain to you how, you know, certainly as the crisis was developing, as the war was developing, as the revolution was happening, whatever we want to call it, you know, there were things that I would see every day, and they became totally normal to me. Again, the checkpoints, the bombings, the sense of fear people had, but also the sense of liberation and these weird, you know, you'd see almost within each person a revolution going on as they were torn between, you know, trying to reshape their understandings of their world and their society and all of those complicated things. And sometimes it became so normal to me, I wouldn't see it. And, you know, a couple of journalists would come in or I would discuss it with people and they'd be like, it sounds amazing, you know. And I, you know, a friend of mine, another journalist came in and he hadn't been into Syria for years. And couldn't believe it, and it was talking about all these things and was writing all these stories that I hadn't written because I was like, well, that's normal, though. That's just, you know, it's totally addy. And so I didn't, you know, I was missing things. You get too close to it, you know, and, but I, you know, I have a notebook. I have hundreds of notebooks, dozens, piled up with all these, you know, detailed notes about what was going on and things. And I'm still not sure if there's any value in them or what I saw or what I understood. It's hard to kind of filter it all, you know, and yeah, it's strange. But anyway, in terms of parachute journalism, I guess I do still feel a bit against it. You know, there are people coming in and you think, you know, they come in and they hit the tarmac and they're immediately kind of talking about this and that. And I do think, you know, and I've heard foreign journalists in Damascus talking about things that they know are true. And I'm sort of sitting there thinking, well, I don't know, you know, I think it's more complicated than that. Or, you know, you actually don't know what you're talking about. Mm. But there's a place for it all, in a sense. There's not a place for not knowing what you're talking about, but there's a place for, you know, you need these guys who come in and kind of hit the ground and get it done. You know, I've got nothing but admiration for them. I can do it.
And there is the fresh eyes argument that you've just made very strongly there if you're seeing the same thing day in, day out. This is why I like, you know, it would be foolish for me to come to this town, city, on the border of Syria and say, right, I'm going to cross over and do a bit of exploring without a fixer, without someone who kind of knows more than one language, without someone with at least a little bit of insight or the contacts. So, you know, it's always an absolute pleasure when we connect and decide to do something together because maybe I have those fresh eyes and I'm able to go, look at that, look at that, look at that. I'm still, you know, I'm snapping like a crazy tourist just walking around the streets here and you're like, it's a man selling bread, man.
Yeah, well, again, but that's part of it. And I do remember, you know, meeting up with you in the past, probably in Amman, and we were walking around and you were taking photos all over the place. And I was thinking, you know, what's this idiot doing? He's taking photos. And then when I saw the photos you've got, I really regretted I didn't have those photos because I always thought either, well, I see this all the time or I'll have them later. I'll do them later. And you don't do them later. You do them immediately or you don't get them done. And there are, again, I do feel like that when you arrive straight away, you see things with fresh eyes. That's a very productive period. Maybe when you've been there a long time, that's a very productive period. Sometimes because you understand more and you have better contacts and people will talk to you. And then there's this weird kind of limbo land between the two where you're not new and seeing things in a fresh way. You don't have experience, you know, so you really maybe do know what you're talking about. Although, again, I have concerns about saying that. But there's this period in between where you're kind of learning the ropes. You know, you're not new anymore. You're not old. You're just kind of a weird, you know, in-between person. And that's kind of can be a barren period. And that's hard to fight against as a journalist. But in terms of, you know, I think the different ways of doing it, you know, that maybe the good thing about all this huge proliferation of media is that you're no longer requiring one person to be everything. You can say, well, okay, this person is the dropping in journalist. He's got this perspective. This person's been there a while. I'll look at him too. And you can kind of triangulate and make your own, you know, get all this different information and make your own decisions about it, you know.
There's so much to learn from, you know, this kind of collaborative working together, and I love the way you always play down your skills, and you're quite self-deprecating. That's it. So you do self-deprecating quite well when you say, oh, you know, I'm not shooting much digital anymore, I'm doing film. And then you explain why, because recently you get taken into a particular office and questioned, and straight away the metadata on your digital images is giving away where you were, what you were looking at, and you were very quietly thankful that you'd shot off a whole... Am I allowed to talk about this?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Whole load of film, right, of quite sensitive information in a rebel hospital?
Yeah, and you know, I'd been down there and been doing these things and got... arrested, whatever we say, a checkpoint, detained, dragged off a bus by the army, and they, you know, taken back to a military interrogation installation, a quite notorious one. Although I'm a foreigner, I was treated, you know, problems, you know, minor kind of dramas in a sense, although I was a bit nervous. But it was just really, it was really interesting. You know, as a journalist, I'd stopped recording anything audio in Syria for the longest time and taking no notes about names, because it's dangerous. You can get people killed if you write names and phone numbers down. So I'd write everything in shorthand notes, which, you know, even I struggle to read sometimes, to be honest, in a notepad, and that's the way I would do business. And names, I didn't even want to know people's names. You know, I knew who I had trustworthy contacts who would put me in touch with people. I don't know. And other Syrians would tell me, and they still do, like, they've developed this remarkable ability to erase names from their minds, so they forget people as soon as they've met them because they don't want to know. Stopped at this checkpoint and was, you know, during the interrogation, they pulled an SD card out of my camera, and I'd only taken two digital photographs because, you know, I was interested in trying to do film, and they just in front of me, you know, popped it in the computer and kind of call up this picture on a screen. And in fact, it was a piece of graffiti written on a side of a school that said, "Don't go, Bashar, we're coming for you." You know, and so they could identify the school, which means suddenly they're like, "Oh, we know where this guy's been, we know what he's doing," and it helps them with the interrogation. But again, happily, I had five or six rolls of, you know, film in my pocket that they were not interested in, because it was a film camera, it was medium format film, you need kind of special chemistry to develop it. They couldn't look at it. You know, and had they tried, they would have exposed the frames. And so I suddenly thought, wow, this has protected me, and it's protected all the people I know. That was it for me. You know, digital was, in terms of inside Syria, I thought, it's the only way to go, you know, obscure film. I mean, it's safety right there. Like,
there's a paper in this, you know, encryption through obscure technology. So that is such an incredibly valuable insight that I would totally oversee. I would go the other way and say, you know, stick the memory card up your bum, or use a format they haven't got a reader for.
Yeah, I mean, I did, you know, that. It's easy to say those things, and you're like, well, you know, the strip search, which happens to people, like, that finds the memory card that you've salted away.
And that's even more interesting now.
Yeah, absolutely, you know, because it looks like you've been trying to hide something, whereas with film, you can hide it in plain sight. It's on the table when they've emptied your bag, and they're like, what's this? That's film. They don't even know if it's been exposed.
Yeah.
You know, they just brush past it. They're, you know, they're just tech savvy enough, for want of a nicer way of putting it, to know that, I don't know, like, yeah, we'll look at the SD card. There's stuff on there. And that was interesting. You know, I had to make it very, you know, when I did get freed, I had to see straight away phone the people who had helped me and say, listen, I hope I haven't compromised you and your location, because they had this information. And again, I think that it's one of the things that's happened, and I suspect it's happened a lot more than gets reported, because journalists don't report about ourselves and our own mistakes. But I suspect, and I know a few cases where people have, you know, really, really gotten into trouble because of sloppy journalism. You know, people writing things in notebooks, getting detained, and then, like, you know, activists and people who have been helping you will get rolled up by the security forces because they've just walked into a hotel room and found a contact book, you know? I mean, or they found an iPhone with a great log of numbers and stuff on, and they're very interested in that. You know, it's a dangerous business, and it's really hard to, you know, I do think it's really important as a journalist, like, you know, your own security is a priority, but so should the security of everyone and meeting you. And it's easy to say that, but it's kind of hard to do. And sometimes you can be careless, and sometimes there's the pressure to get a story. And the people who are helping you want you to get the story as well. And they sometimes take shortcuts and risks, and it's complicated and difficult stuff, you know. And yeah, it's not pleasant, actually.
Now, you use a lot of social technology when it comes to platforms for your research, as any journalist will do nowadays, kind of plug into the hive mind and the conversations that are going on, although yours is very, very Syrian focused, the networks that you've built for obvious reasons. You're Phil Sands on Twitter, I hope you don't mind me saying that. You haven't tweeted, because... Well, a lot of the reasons we've just been talking about, you know, I'm just in this cafe, come and arrest me, kind of thing could have happened.
Yeah, I think there is that, you know, you sort of make your choice in terms of what you want to do. And one of the things that I think helped me stay in Syria for a long time was, you know, I was writing for The National, which is, you know, I think it's a fairly respectable newspaper, and it's got some good correspondents writing for it. But it's not as well known, of course, as The New York Times or The Guardian and those things. So I think that kind of helped me. I was in a really lucky position, I think, where I was present and able to work, but I wasn't, what I wrote was not landing on the minister's desk the next day and causing outrage and getting me thrown out of the country. I was in this weird sort of liminal zone between being able to be in there, but being obscure enough and not being recognized and you know, that I could stay and work. And so that was really important to me. And I was fastidious about my obscurity, in a sense. You know, I wouldn't want to tweet. Plus, I'd end up tweeting banalities. You know, I feel like it takes me a long time to put together a story and all of those kinds of things, and I wouldn't want to slip into just kind of, you know, trying to tweet sound bites. Plus, I'm not very pithy, you know, 140 words. You know, I run off
characters,
of
yeah.
Yeah, 140 characters. I mean, I'm always being edited for length because I've written, you know, 1,500 words too much or something, and so...
It might teach you something, suddenly having to make sense in 140 characters. I think we've had a conversation about you at least sharing your stories, because, you know, it just makes it easier for people to share that outside of The National. But who knows, you might have some dubious characters subscribing to your feed and you have to go into lockdown. Do you feel a little bit more relaxed now that you're in Turkey?
Yeah, very much. It was, you know, leaving Syria, I really did. It's amazing how much you internalize all of that. You know, I remember, again, sitting with a friend and kind of I was talking about, God, I don't even want to say his name now, a senior regime figure. And I was sitting with a friend and I leaned forward and whispered the guy's name, you know, because you just don't say this guy's name in Syria. Again, in the rebel-held areas, they shout curses about it. But the area I was in was one of these contested areas, in a sense. And so... You know, I leaned forward and whispered it, and he was delighted. Like, he just laughed at me and was like, you know, they get you as well, you know, that you internalize this stuff. Even a foreigner, he's like, and they're not going to do anything to you. They'll kick you out. There's not the same cost involved. So leaving was, you know, I hate to say it, I'm really sad to have left. I wish I could still be there in many ways, but there was also, you know, the shutters had come in. I could only see so much. And yeah, when I left, it was like, oh, God, I can breathe again, you know? Wow, this is what it feels like. I can think, you know? And again, there is this danger of, you know, when you're worrying about a visa, and again, it's something journalists don't like to talk about, and I don't like to talk about it myself, but there's a slight element of self-censorship comes in, or you might not say it's not self-censorship, it's just ultra care in terms of what you're writing, because word choice can be the difference between staying in and getting kicked out. And of course, you don't want to be soft-peddling stories. You've got to write the truth, and you... etc., etc. But you also, you know, you have to be careful in the way you phrase things, and sometimes that can be very simple. You can say exactly the same thing in two ways, and one will get you thrown out of the country, and one will get, you know, a slap on the wrist, and that's a huge difference. And so you're balancing those things. And now I'm out. I hope I'm not writing in a cavalier way. I don't mean to be. I hope I've not lost any sense of proportion. But it does. You feel much more like, okay, I can breathe again. This is what journalism is. You know, I think in Syria, journalism had become almost impossible. I can't imagine it getting much more impossible to work as a journalist. You know, you couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't, by the time I left, you could hardly move. You know, I had paperwork and I was going through checkpoints, and people were saying that, you know, the security people were saying I'd forged the paperwork. You know, at which point you're like, well, I can't do anything. I'm here legit and I can't move, you know. And so it was getting as close to complete suffocation as it was possible to be.
And of course, there were some moments when, you know, I'd get a phone call from you. The internet was turned off, for example. You were relying for a while on a BGAN.
No, actually, I didn't. I never took one into Syria.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, they were illegal. You know, that's a...
Yeah, let's not draw attention to that.
Yeah, and so, no, I mean, it's fine. Again, I think, you know...
But how were you getting copy out? Were you doing old school down the telephone?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Wow. Yeah, down a landline, you know, which was crackly and terrible. But, you know, I wonder if it was almost one of those things, like the landlines were left sometimes, you know, certainly in my area, and you could get copy out with a landline. But, yeah, I never took a satellite modem in. They're illegal, and again, the decision was made in conjunction with my boss at the newspaper that, you know, we would not take that risk, you know, we would not do that. And so, yeah, we didn't. It was always... Yeah, often it would be very late night, like filing copy over a phone, you know. And, you know, again, there was a really nice guy on the foreign desk, you know, old school kind of journalist, an American journalist, who would be taking copy down over the phone. And, like, he was like, this is how we used to do it, man, you know. And he's got a phone in the crook of his ear. He's like, my neck's not used. It's been years since I've had the phone in the crook of my neck, you know. And he was typing out my copy and correcting it as we go. And it was really... you know, from a craft point of view, it was interesting. It's really hard, you know. Yeah. It's embarrassing to be reading out your copy down a phone. You want to correct it as you're going all the time.
I just picture some wooden phone booth in a smoky bar, and it's kind of romantic in a way, with very dark undertones for the reasons why you have to do this. Well, I'll save audio updates as to what we're going to be doing over the next few days for another time. It might be that we can't necessarily talk too much about what we're doing, but it's safe to say that you will be popping back. We will be popping back into Syria and hopefully sharing some stories from there. How long has this been going for? 2 and a bit years?
Yeah, this is the third year of it now. It all kind of started in March of 2011.
How long do you see it continuing for? I know you can't predict the future.
I'm just a journalist. I don't do the future. You know, I do yesterday. I've no. It's sort of anyone's guess. You know, I think when it started, if you'd said to a lot of people who were involved in it, this is going to take, you know, 2 years plus, and, you know, who even knows how many people dead now? I think, you know, the 70,000 dead quoted by the UN is, everyone kind of considers that a pretty conservative estimate. You know, it doesn't include the wounded and the disappeared and all of those terrible things. I think people would have. You know, people would have thought that was... They would. I think a lot of people wouldn't have thought it would go like that. It wouldn't be that far. It's a hard one to predict with Syria, you know. I mean, God, it's complicated. In a way, it's not complicated. It's a very simple thing. It's, you know, it's basically, it started with people going out and asking for a bit of political reform, you know, but it all turned ugly so quickly. You know, again, as I sort of said at the beginning, the kind of black heart of the place, you know, was very much thrown into sort of stark relief. You know, it was thrown into the open. But, that doesn't really answer the question, does it? I don't know how long it's going
to
last.
No, I don't expect you to kind of know, but I can sense that this is such a big story that gets reported and reported and reported. But you've said the complexities of Syria, the complexities of this region is just too big at the moment to fathom.
Yeah, again, it is and it isn't sometimes. I do think, like, you know, it's one of those things that you can tie yourself in knots on it, because it is. It's so complicated, and there's so many people interested in Syria, and there's, you know, Syria itself is so, in a sense, unknowable, but at the same time, knowable, you know. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, but, you know, really, during the first years I'd been there, there were times of complete despair when I would feel like, I don't know anything about this place. And, again, like, my Syrian friends would be like, yeah, now you know how we feel. You know, we're Syrian, we don't know this place. You know, we have senses of it. We have little bits and pieces. It's like, you know, you're looking at a jigsaw puzzle, but you're allowed to see three pieces only at a time, and there are different three pieces, and so on and so forth, and you're expected to, you know, it's an impossible place. And on the other hand, it is very simple. You know, again, some people would say, look, it's a ruling elite that have held on to power. They believe they have the right to hold on to power, come what may, for as long as, you know, until eternity, as they say, you know, the leader until eternity, forever. That's what they would call the leader. And so that's it. It's basic. It's a very, you know, what could be more human than that, right? Like a struggle for power.
Well, we're going to be working together, and I'm very much looking forward to it over the next few days. I'm going to try to gently coerce Phil into sharing some of his writings, some of his recent copy that he's filing to The National on his Twitter account, which is
at Phil Sands, S-A-N-D-S. I'm at Documentally, and we're currently in Gaziantep.
Can I just add something? This is the other thing that kind of seems strange about Twitter, is this weird self-promotion, right? You have to, like, here I am, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. It seems odd. I don't know.
You don't have to do that. I mean, I very rarely ever say who I am, because if you've clicked on the link, you know who it is, because it's linked to the account. I guess I just want to put a little bit more importance on the fact that we are here. I massively respect your work, and I'm mentioning you because I do hope people connect with you. I do hope that there is some kind of organic amplification about the work that you do. You put your heart, your soul, your passion into the work you do, and there's years and God knows how many thousands of works from hardback books, even before you got your Kindle, that you've had to digest, I think, to get a grip on what it is you do, and I do respect that, and I don't think that many people have the time to do that anymore. Their deadlines are just so harsh, and they're forced into a corner with their very low-paid journalistic jobs as things get worse and worse, and I'm going to say, you don't know how lucky you are. But you even said to me earlier on, you know, you love your job.
Yeah, no, it's true. I'm allowed to basically write what I want, which is unimaginable, you know.
And that's why people should read it. And that's why you should make it easy for them to read it, not have to Google five pages in to find the National.
Yeah, I suppose it's true. You know, it's very old-fashioned, you know, to be able to send a reporter out somewhere and just say, okay, you know, we're not going to tell you what to write. You tell us what to write. And I've always been lucky having that as a direction, because that's what you want as a journalist. You know, there's nothing more frustrating than effectively following a news agenda that's set by somebody else who's reading someone else's work, you know, and it all comes from the same source. It's much better if you've got people out there saying, you know, you tell me what the story is, you know, and that yeah, I like that. It's old-fashioned. I wonder how long that'll last. You know?
I'll remind you about self-promotion on articles when you complain about not getting a byline next time, okay?
Yeah.
Or a photo caption. Yeah. I'm going to step outside and let you listen to a couple of seconds of Gaziantep and the sounds of the street here in Turkey. Well, nearly got attacked by a pigeon, which is just topping up the poo on the balcony.